Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. Today is the 31st day of January, 2019. This is it, friends. It's the last day of the month. So I think that after today, we're not allowed to say Happy New Year anymore. There's some sort of social rule related to that. So even if up until today, it was the first time that you'd run into somebody or talk to somebody and you hadn't, you know, it's the first time in the new year you've done that and you sort of allowed to say Happy New Year. But I think after today, that's like somehow socially wrong. So we can wish them, you know, we can still wish people some sort of wonderful greeting about this being the year of the Lord and this is the day that the Lord has made, you know, because that's always good. So let's just go with that. Okay, so I have some good news for you in this religious liberty story that we've been following globally. You will remember that Asia Bibi is a Christian who lives in Pakistan. You will recall that a number of years ago, some Muslim co-workers of hers in a field, day laborers, all very poor people in terms of their financial capacity. So they were all day laborers. Asia was sent to get water. She returned with the bucket of water, and when she dipped into the bucket to get herself a drink, those who were around her and viewed Christians as unworthy of dipping their hand in the same bucket of water as them. They then accused her of committing blasphemy. Now, that controversy rose through the court system. Asia Bibi was convicted. She spent a number of years on death row in Pakistan. And then you will recall that the Supreme Court in Pakistan took up her case. And in October of 2018, so some 3 months ago now, Pakistan's Supreme Court acquitted her of blasphemy charges. And she'd been on death row for, at that point, more than almost a decade. It's a full decade now. So the court claimed that there was ultimately not enough evidence to convict her. And then there were uprisings around the country by fundamentalist Muslims who wanted to see her killed no matter what, like regardless of what the law says, regardless of whether or not it could be proven that she had committed blasphemy. It didn't matter to them. They wanted her dead. And Pakistan refused up until this point to allow her to leave. She has been seeking asylum. Her family has been seeking asylum globally. Many countries around the world have denied her asylum for fear of Muslim uprisings in their own countries. But Canada has extended her an invitation for asylum. Her children, her daughters, apparently have been secretly in Canada now for some time. Canada has formally offered her asylum, and Pakistan has agreed to allow her to leave, to join her family and be reunited in Canada. So I can hardly wait for those images and those pictures of the reunion of that mother with her children, having been separated now for a full decade under false charges against a Christian committing blasphemy against the Prophet Muhammad over, frankly, whether or not you could dip your hand in the same bucket of water as other day laborers in the fields of Pakistan. Friends, that's what some people around the world are dealing with today. So I realize that there are a lot of us who are complaining that our toes are cold. And I recognize that for some folks, the extreme cold weather is actually deadly. And certainly we want to be doing for our neighbors who do not have enough to keep them warm. We want to be extending our hospitality, and we want to be extending grace to those who need help in these days. But let's also recall the first world problems that we face and the very real issues of persecution our brothers and sisters are facing around the world. The millions of people who are displaced internally in their own countries because of religious persecution and war, and those who are refugees around the globe today. And so I have all of that in mind as I turn to a couple of headlines that, frankly, as Christians, you're going to say to yourself, wow, this is just evidence that things in our country have gotten to a place where I'm not even completely sure how I'm going to engage in the conversations of the day. And so that's what we're here to talk about today on Connecting Faith. Let's get equipped for the real conversations going on in the world in which we live. Let's survey the headline news. So this is from the BBC yesterday, and it is, you could read it in conversation with the same news story by the New York Times and elsewhere. But if you go to the BBC, it's for free, and everywhere else, you know, it's behind a paywall. So I offer it up to you from the BBC's coverage. Here's the headline. How do you compost a human body, and why would you, if you were to read the same headline or the story, same related story in the New York Times? You would have this: Washington State weighs new option after death, human composting. I want you to just think for a moment about those two words put together. Human and composting. You and I both know what compost is. And some of us have composting bins or composting piles or composting efforts. Never in, I think, my wildest imagination would I have thought to put the word human in front of the word compost, or the word human in front of the word composting. So what's going on here, and how is the state of Washington involved, or what's going on in the state of Washington, to which we need to be paying attention and need to be aware. So here's the lead. A person's final resting place could be the foundation of a flower bed, or could feed the roots of a tree. This is what Washington State is preparing to legalize. If the bill passes, the Western state would be the first in the nation to allow human composting as a burial option. Here's what it means to choose a compost burial, and why a growing group of Americans are looking at this new way to rest in peace. Okay, I want to take those concepts just for a moment. Rest in peace. If you, first of all, think that you are resting when you die, then you are embracing the biblical idea that there is a sleep that takes place. That's the way Paul actually refers to those who have died, that they are sleeping. Because one day they will be awakened again to newness of life over the resurrection of the body at the general resurrection that comes when Jesus returns. This concept of resting in peace also suggests that there is a peace enjoyed by those who die, what? In faith. And so this is one of those opportunities for us to talk about death, the reality of death, what happens after we die. It gives us an opportunity to talk about the Prince of Peace and the one in whom we find our rest. This actual conversation, which you may be horrified when you start considering what they're actually talking about, but you also may say to yourself, you know what? This is actually a far more natural way for Earth, the body to return earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Maybe this is not so bad. Maybe a simple cardboard box with an unembalmed body in a burial plot that is family owned is somehow okay. And so I'm not suggesting to you that the idea is bad. I'm suggesting that the presentation of the idea is kind of horrible. The notion that it's human compost really does degrade that the body does matter. And again, we could get into the conversation about the body mattering, because matter matters. And Jesus bears witness to the importance of the body in taking on human flesh to dwell among us. That's the incarnation. Jesus bears witness to the body's importance by his physical resurrection from the dead in the physical body, and by his physical ascension into heaven, seated at the right hand of the Father, where he is even now, and from whence he will return. So it's an opportunity, if you actually read these articles, it's an opportunity to see through the worldview of those who believe that the body is simply a physical, reality, and that it has no spiritual consequence whatsoever. And these people would also try to spiritualize. This is what I find particularly interesting. Part of the reason that they want to move into this formalized human composting approach is they actually want some ceremony. They want there to be some opportunities for, there to be a tree under which their remains are going to somehow return, somehow be recycled, somehow be to become again something that is living. Now, that speaks to our innate internal desire as spiritual beings to recognize that we have an eternal reality. They simply think that their eternal reality is going to be that their body is composted and therefore feeding the flowers and the trees. And you and I would say it's so much more than that. There is going to be a general resurrection of the dead. And when that happens in Jesus Christ, we want to be found as people who have faith in him in order that we too might ascend to heaven and spend our eternity there. All right, friends, I am going to have a conversation today with Dan Darling. He is the Vice President of Communications for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. He's also a pastor. He's a dad. He's an excellent conversation partner. He and I are going to talk through a number of headlines today. Our conversation is going to lead off with sort of where we are as a nation in terms of the conversation related to abortion. So you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm Carmen LaBurge. I'll be right back with Dan Darling. Hey friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, joined now by Daniel Darling. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Darling, among other things. He's the author of The Dignity Revolution, a book that if you have not yet laid your hands on, it's time. It's time to get it. He and I have talked about that book here before on Connecting Faith. We've also talked about things that he is doing at the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission, where he serves as the Vice President of Communications. So Dan, welcome back to Connecting Faith.
Great to be here, Carmen. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. You?
Yes, I am. Very well. Yeah, just as we're not supposed to say, but trying to stay warm here.
Exactly. Okay, so we have talked previously here on Connecting Faith about the new law in New York and related to abortion and really putting absolutely no limits whatsoever on a woman's opportunity to get an abortion all the way up to the point of birth. We have also been hearing in the last 24 hours of the news cycle, news out of Virginia, where the governor is basically, you know, defending proposed legislation related to having abortion available there all the way up through the 40th week and including when a woman is in labor. I would love to dialogue with you about how the conversation surrounding abortion rights has changed actually pretty rapidly. Here, both positively and negatively. So I'm going to let you start on either side of that. Positively, how has the abortion conversation changed, and then also negatively?
Well, I mean, positively it's changed in the fact that I think, you know, the pro-life community, of which I would consider myself a member, has, you know, for almost 50 years, you know, introduced the moral vocabulary into the culture that the most defenseless human beings, the unborn, are worthy of dignity and respect and protection, that they're not cells, they're not fetuses, they're human beings. And I think even you see this even in those that are called themselves pro-choice, it's hard for them not to acknowledge that. I think what's kind of distressing is just the way that, you know, just sort of the rhetoric of the pro-choice community has kind of gone from, you know, in the sort of the 1990s era, you think of you know, Bill Clinton and others saying abortion's sort of a tragic choice, but let's keep it safe, legal, and rare. In other words, you know, it's something that nobody wants to do, but let's have the option. To now, where really, you know, you see Planned Parenthood and NARAL saying shout your abortion. There's even articles that say yes, we know it's a human being. Yes, we know there's a heartbeat, and yes, we still think it's a good idea that we have this in our culture. And I also think the other distressing thing is just how much they're pushing and celebrating this. You just think of the New York and Virginia legislation where, you know, abortion up to the moment that children are being born until they are, you know, and even in some cases, you know, even after they're born. So to me, that sort of doubling down on this what we would call infanticide is really distressing.
Again, friends, my conversation partner today is Daniel Darling. He is the Vice President for Communications for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. You can find him at ERLC. And you can also find him on Twitter. He's a good follow, at Dan Darling. So, Dan, I think that 4D sonograms, for me, are one of the things that technology has given us, you know, in the last handful of years, that makes it impossible for anyone who's paying attention, anyone who wants to know, to deny that it's a human life. And so I think that when we see and hear and experience the conversation related to abortion and the debate related to abortion move in the direction that you have described, which is celebratory, and that's so odd to me. It's grievous for one group of people and yet so strangely celebrated by another group of people. So I guess I'm wondering what you think is happening in the heart and the mind and the life of a person who can say, you know what, I know it's a heartbeat, I know it's a human being, I've seen the 4D sonogram, and yet what I want is what I want when I want it or when I don't want it, and I have the absolute right to eliminate that other human being. What does that tell you about our culture and I guess where we are?
Well, I think it's the age-old temptation that I do not want to see what my eyes are seeing, that I want to turn away. And I think this is a temptation, not just with this issue of abortion. I think it's the most acute issue. I think it's the one where, you know, the media, for the most part, and, you know, many in our elite institutions want to sort of do as the religious leaders do on the road to Jericho, to sort of, you know, put on blinders and say, I don't see the vulnerable right there. I don't see their humanity. Yes, they're showing me a 4D ultrasound, and I'm just closing my eyes, and I will not see the humanity unborn. But I also think there's kind of a searing of consciences. I think there's a, you know, I think the value of personal autonomy is so high, and the idea that I want to be able to do whatever I want is so high that I think it trumps really, you know, any other kind of, you know, care for whoever might get in the way. And I think you see this rhetoric across the spectrum. Whenever there's a group of people who are perceived as an obstacle to another group of people's flourishing. So the unborn are seen as an obstacle to the flourishing of women. Now we deny that narrative and say, actually, you know, children enrich our lives and children, you know, make us fuller. But that is kind of the narrative that babies are sort of an obstacle to the flourishing of women. I think you see it sometimes in some of the rhetoric we hear about things like immigration and other difficult issues, that here's a group of people whose flourishing is an obstacle to this other group of people's flourishing. And so we kind of work to dehumanize them in order to commit harm. And I think as Christians, we always have to be the kind of people that say, where are the vulnerable around us? Where are the people that are most likely to have their voices silenced? Where are the people who are most likely to be ignored? And these are the people that the people of God must come alongside and say, no, they're humans, they're people, and they're worthy of respect and protection.
And when they can't lift up a voice of their own, it becomes my responsibility as a Christian to be their voice. And so I think that, again, we want to encourage Christians to enter into conversation. We want you to do so with humility and with grace, but with absolute honesty. And the moral vocabulary that Dan offered early on in this conversation about dignity and respect and protection. If you read Dignity Revolution, you'll also get a hefty dose of what this means for all of life, not just the preborn, not just those of us who are reborn in Christ, advocating for the preborn, but what this actually looks like to substantively come alongside, let's say, a young woman who does choose to carry her baby to term and have that baby? How do we as the church enfold her in the life of a generationally robust community of believers who can help her raise that child in every way that that means to raise that child? And so we have to be doing more as the body of Christ, as the family of faith, after children are born as well. And so, Dan, I know you concur with me on all of that. So can we move to a second subject? And this is because so you're such a, you know, you're like a real communications professional. I just talk on the radio. So one of the things that you do in your role is like, right, you prepare people for things like, hey, they're going to appear on CNN. So I saw Chris Sims, who is a communications professional. He has written a book about his time in the Trump White House. And during an interview on CNN, he made this very interesting comment that I would love to discuss with you. So while Chris Sims was being interviewed on CNN, the president of the United States actually tweeted that this guy, Chris, is a low-level staffer I hardly knew named Cliff Sims. He wrote yet another boring book based on made-up stories and fiction. He pretended to be an insider when, in fact, he was nothing more than a gopher. He signed a non-disclosure agreement. He is a mess. Okay, so that's not nice for anybody to say about anybody, and we could have all kinds of responses. I want you to imagine for a moment you're live on CNN talking about a book that you have written, and the president of the United States actually inserts himself into the conversation through Twitter, and the CNN commentator turns to you and asks you to respond. Chris Sims responded by saying, my identity is not wrapped up in being a Trump staffer. My identity is wrapped up in who I am and my faith. And those are things that matter to me. I know who Jesus says I am. It doesn't matter to me what Donald Trump or anyone else says. I would just love for you as a communications person to kind of respond to all that.
See, I thought Cliff did such a great job there. And, you know, to be able to have the poise to respond, I've been on network television, and it's a kind of a nerve-wracking experience. It looks easy, but you know, you got all the lights on you. You don't want to say anything stupid. And he really, you know, he really reacted, I think, in a way that demonstrated a strong Christian faith to say, "Listen, my identity is not wrapped up in all this. My identity is in Christ." And you know, those of us that work on these issues, and especially those who are in the Beltway or in the thick of it, like he was, it's so easy to make that your life and make that your identity. And the fact that he says, hey, you know, I'm a follower of Christ, and, you know, that doesn't bother me. This is, I'm moving forward. I think he handled it incredibly well with grace and poise. The Bible talks about don't return evil for evil or insults for insults, and I think he practiced that well. On a much less important note, but I think kind of funny, you know, anytime the president wants to tweet about a book, I think the author is always happy to see that, you know, to make sure everyone's now talking about it and to raise the book sales. So I'm sure he wasn't too disappointed that, you know, the president sort of kept his book flowing through the news cycle. So I'm just saying, if he wants to tweet something really terrible about the Dignity Revolution, you know, I'm okay with that.
Bring it on. All right, friends, we're going to take a break. When we come back, Dan and I are actually going to continue our conversation. We're going to talk about vaccines and love of neighbor, and we're also going to talk about what's on the agenda for the ERLC in 2019. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, and we'll be right back. Hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge, continuing my conversation with Daniel Darling. He is the Vice President of Communications for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Darling. You can follow the ERLC at ERLC. Dan, let's continue our conversation. Let's move to the subject of vaccines. First of all, just give people a little update. What's going on with measles? And then let's talk about the Christian perspective on getting our kids vaccinated.
Well, from what I understand, and I'm not a medical professional, but it seems there are places around the country where there are sort of pockets of populations where certain really deadly strains of viruses and other diseases that we thought were sort of we don't have to worry about anymore are starting to come back, you know, things like measles, things like even in some places polio and other things like that. And it's really distressing for, you know, when I talk to, you know, medical professionals, you know, Christian medical professionals that are actually in this space working every day to create cures for, you know, life-saving cures for diseases, both here and in the developing world. It's really distressing to see, and much of it, people feel are related to people who are who don't vaccinate their children and don't get vaccinations. And so, I think one of the things we need to think about as followers of Christ is that, you know, we are not just here by ourselves, but we're members of communities, we're neighbors, and can we adequately love our neighbors if we're not willing to vaccinate, in a sense, to, you know, inoculate ourselves against some of these drugs? Because what happens when a cluster of people don't vaccinate, from what I understand, it allows these sort of once dormant viruses and diseases to sort of take root and catch on. And it really can be devastating, not necessarily to the people that don't take the vaccines, but to people like really young children, babies, and the elderly. And so, you know, you may be unwittingly being a carrier of some kind of disease that you spread that goes to someone who's in a vulnerable position. And so I think as Christians, we have to think two things. One, how can I love my neighbor? This is one way to love my neighbors myself, is to vaccinate. And number two, I think, you know, sometimes I think Christians don't understand that, you know, fighting disease, fighting sickness and death and all these things, the kind of life-saving work that some of our leading doctors and people do, you know, is a redemptive work. You know, it's pushing back against the fall. It's you know, a tiny glimpse of what we know will come when Jesus returns in the kingdom, when he'll heal and restore and make all things new. And so I really applaud actually those who are in this kind of work who not only work on that stuff here, but also go around the world and in places that, you know, are developing countries and really working to save lives this way.
Yeah. Our friend, Mindy Belts at World Magazine, she just was talking last week about, how because of the advent of drones, they're now able to actually deploy vaccines to really remote communities where they haven't been able to do that before, because in order to take the vaccines, a person had to go. And that put those populations at risk for whatever it was that they were trying to vaccinate them against. And so it's on the one hand, we have vaccines advancing globally in really significant ways. And yet here in the United States, we have just this anti-vaccine. It's more than just a minor deal. It's a real movement in some pockets and communities. And so, you know, I wanted our listeners to be aware of this. There, you know, there's actually a bill before the Washington State Assembly related to ending personal exemptions from vaccines. And that's really not targeting people who have some sort of religious exemption against vaccines. It's actually this growing trend of folks who want to have it's vaccine skepticism might be the way to say it, and it's actually emerging in some very exclusive communities across the country, very, you know, what we might consider very liberal communities.
Yeah.
Who are very affluent, and I find that kind of fascinating, and they're refusing to vaccinate their children, like at the level of like 70% in one school in North Carolina. 70% of the kids are not vaccinated against measles and smallpox, and I mean I find it kind of astonishing. So maybe I'm just naive, and I'm probably going to hear from a flood of listeners. You guys can email me, carmen@myfaithradio.com, if you know, got...
Yeah, forward all that email to Carmen, by the way.
I know. I'm not sending them to you, Dan. Don't worry.
Okay,
let's talk about the ERLC's 2019 agenda. Again, friends, it's the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Church. And tell us what the ERLC is looking at this year. What's on the horizon?
Well, you know, every year we publish our agenda, and this is just kind of, you know, we're tasked by the Southern Baptist Convention. We're supported by the churches of the SBC to speak on behalf of Southern Baptists in the nation's capital, and we have a incredible team in Washington, D.C., led by Travis Wusso and others who are fighting every day on some of these really, really important issues. And every year we publish what we call our legislative agenda, and I really encourage people to go look at it and download it. You can go to our website, erlc.com, and find it there. And I'm not going to run through all of this stuff, but really at the top of our list are some really, really key, important things. Like, so for instance, we think about one of our key and important issues is the sanctity of human life. We just talked about that. And so we're at the, you know, a lot of this stuff happens at the state level, but at the federal level, there's several things that we're concerned about. One is the No Taxpayer Funding for Abortion Act. There's been a couple of senators that have proposed this, and I think this is really good public policy that essentially says no taxpayer dollars should ever go for funding of abortion. And you'd think that we have this in place because of things like the Hyde Amendment, but there's ways around that, and there's ways that these organizations get funded both internationally and other ways that we'd like to see not happen. We'd love to see abortion outlawed, but at the very least, we should not have to have our tax dollars go to something like that. And similar to that is the Protecting the Hyde Amendment. And so the Hyde Amendment was kind of a compromise, you know, 40 years ago. Henry Hyde, who's from Illinois, my home state, kind of spearheaded this, which essentially says that taxpayers, there can't be any taxpayer funding of abortions. And I know there's many on the left who want to remove this and want to fund abortions through taxpayer money, so trying to protect that. There's just some other things, too, like the Conscience Protection Act, which protects doctors, medical professionals who have a conscientious objection to abortion to not have to participate in the procedure and can be protected, particularly thinking like Catholic hospitals and other places where, you know, can Catholic institutions and other institutions be able not to perform those procedures, and can medical professionals in other institutions have that freedom? So there's a bunch of things like that. Also things having to do with religious liberty. We'd love to defund Planned Parenthood. We'd love to push back on things like physician-assisted suicide. But we're also talking about religious liberty, family and marriage. We're really trying to help tackle the opioid crisis in communities. And then last year, we feel like there were some really great wins on things like criminal justice reform, and we want to continue to push to make sure that we have a justice system that is fair and equitable. And of course, we're also concerned about the issue of DACA and border security. You know, can we find a way to both secure our borders and, you know, the children who are brought here as children? Can we find a way to not have them be sent back to a place that they don't know and have access to some of the opportunity that other Americans have here? So there's a wide-ranging list. I encourage people to check it out. But really, our main focus is always to think through and to advocate for the sanctity of human life, for family formation, religious liberty, and some of these justice issues as well.
So, friends, you can find all of that at erlc.com. It's in their resource library. Actually, I think the easiest way to do it is to click on press and just go to the most recent press release, because it just pops up right there, and that's super handy and helpful. So, Dan, when you think about not just legislatively what's happening, because I know you guys are focused on that and you got a great team in D.C. working on that. When you think about at the congregational level and even the personal level, like, bring this home for us in terms of, okay, so, you know, I live where I live. I go to church where I go to church. I intersect with the people I intersect with. How practically can I be an advocate for, you know, this the broad spectrum pro-life agenda that you've just outlined, everything from, you know, advocating for the Hyde Amendment and advocating against physician-assisted suicide, or advocating for the welfare of children in my own community. I mean, on and on and on. Talk with us a little bit about sort of how does an individual bring it home?
Well, I think we do in a couple ways. First of all, I have to decide, okay, what's my calling? You know, some people do have a calling to directly advocate in the nation's capital, whether you work on a congressional staff or work in the executive branch or in the media or think tanks. Those are very, very important roles, and I'm grateful for really good solid, committed Christians doing work every day on behalf of these things, because they really care. They love their neighbors. They want to create a society that flourishes for everybody. Whether or not you disagree with everything that everybody advocates for, that's really what motivates most of the Christians that are working in the nation's capital. But I think for the average person, for most of us on a daily basis, you know, we're not proposing legislation. We're not doing those things. But I think it's important that we care about these issues. You know, if we are to obey, I think that we're really to obey two commands. We're to obey the Great Commission, to share the good news that Christ has come and we can have peace with God, and that Christ is returning again to renew and restore the world, and the Great Commandment to love our neighbor as ourselves. And if it's hard for me to say that I'm fully loving my neighbor if I have an opportunity to make my voice heard or to do something on behalf of my neighbor, and to create a better society for their flourishing, and I don't do that. It's hard for me to say I fully love them as myself. Now, that may look different for every person. You know, for some people, that's, you know, an activist role. For most of us, it's, you know, looking around our community and say, how can I be a part of this? You know, if God stirs your heart toward education, for instance, how can I be a part of shaping our schools and shaping the next generation of children? Or if it's a poverty issue, or if it's, you know, the pro-life issue, how can I really invest and help my local pregnancy resource center? There's all sorts of ways to get involved. And I, you know, first and foremost, encourage people to get involved through their local church. You know, how can I, through the ministry of my local church, look around and say, okay, what are ways that I can serve my community? You know, being active on the issues is not just about being mad on Twitter and Facebook, you know, every 2 to 4 years when there's an election. I think that's what some of us think, that I did my part. You know, I shared a meme on Facebook, I'm done. But it's actually about getting involved in our communities and in the local communities through my local church that really, I think, has the most lasting impact.
Okay, so one more question before I let you go, because today, posted at danieldarling.com, you have your Way Forward podcast. And is it Way Forward, Way Home?
The Way Home, but who's counting?
The Way Home. The Way Home podcast, and your conversation partner is Raleigh Sadler, and it's on his new book. So I'm actually talking with him about that on like the first of the week. So tell us what you learned.
Well, Raleigh is a fantastic guy. You'll love him as a guest on here. He's, I think, one of the foremost experts on the issue of human trafficking. And one of the things that's so interesting about what he's saying about human trafficking and how to fight that is the idea of vulnerability. And his new book, Vulnerable, really talks about, you know, how do we come alongside the most vulnerable people in our society so that they are not targeted by those who would traffic them and do them harm. That's really one of the best deterrents to human trafficking. And he also talks about how, you know, we are not just positioned as, you know, the strong rescuers of the vulnerable. We, to ourselves, once we see our own vulnerability before God, we're then able to help other vulnerable people. So I think you're going to love Raleigh. His organization, Let My People Go, is a great, great ministry. I'm on the board, and I really highly recommend what he's doing.
Okay, friends, you can check out that podcast at danieldarling.com. It leads the page right now. It's a conversation with Raleigh Sadler, and we're excited to actually have Raleigh back as well. Hey, Dan, thank you so much for joining us again today on Connecting Faith and for what you do every day to advance the kingdom.
Thank you, Carmen. I appreciate your show and appreciate the work that you're doing.
Thank you. All right, friends, I got one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Wherever I go, hey, friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Let's spend a few minutes making the connecting point. So it's this portion of the program where I really am trying to be sure that the rubber hits the road for each and every one of us as Christians in the cultural conversations of our day. You know, where are the places and spaces where we are, as ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven, really going to bring the mind of Christ to bear in ways that honor Jesus? What are the conversations that we are going to be in? What are the environments where we're going to find ourselves that need redemption, that need a redemptive voice? And so I had an experience yesterday that I just feel compelled to share. And so I had cause yesterday to sit in a county courthouse in a courtroom for most of the morning. And it's you have to pass by juvenile court and general sessions in order to get to a room called Chancery Court, where I spent my morning. So the judge in Chancery Court, I actually have no idea all the kinds of things that he hears. I can tell you the kinds of things that he dealt with yesterday. So this is my very limited experience in Chancery Court. I heard him deal with three kinds of cases: adoption, estate issues that obviously did not fit probate court or they would have been heard over there, and issues related to what I will describe as parental rights and child custody. So all in all, they're issues related to the breakdown of the American family. I mean, they may deal with other stuff in Chancery Court, but I will tell you that in my very limited experience, everything going on in there is because of the breakdown of the family. I found myself simultaneously grieved and in total awe of one particular group of people. So I was grieved that there were parents who didn't even bother to show up at a hearing where their parental rights were being terminated and their child was being adopted by someone else. In every case, at least in the time that I was there, the person who was adopting the child was an extended family member who had to swear under oath that their brother or their sister or their cousin or their child had abandoned their parental responsibility for the child under consideration. I was grieved. I was grieved by what that means, and by what that child has experienced, and by what that child now thinks about parental love and their value, and all the kinds of awful stuff that is assuredly a part of the story that led to those families being in court yesterday. I was also in total awe of the men and women who were stepping up and stepping in and swearing under oath to adopt a child or children into their own household, into their family, and raise them as their very own with all of the responsibilities that that entails and all of the challenges that come with kids. So I was so deeply grieved, and I was simultaneously in a state of such tremendous awe. In fairly swift succession, through a number of cases that sounded oddly similar, but the personal details of which are likely dramatically different, parental rights were terminated, custody was awarded, adoption was granted, names were changed, and then the court moved on to the next case. So much goes unsaid in what amounts to a largely impersonal statement of facts. There'd been no contact, no support. There'd been no answer to a summons to appear. Now, you and I both know the layers of sadness and strife and grief and very likely addiction or mental illness that lie beneath the surface of each and every one of those stories. And while on other days I have witnessed men and couples adopting, yesterday, every individual who stood before this particular court on this particular day to adopt a child was relatively young. They were all single women. And I will tell you, you can't do this, but I wanted to rush up and hug them as they passed through that swinging gate back into the gallery where we were seated. And they collected their coat and they walked out of that courtroom as the legal mom of a child or children who they have in many cases been raising with no support for years. And I felt like there should be a group of people surrounding her. There should be a prayer. There should be some kind of ceremony. But there's simply the striking of the gavel in order that the next case might be heard. And then there were the cases related to estates. One man whose mother died, he couldn't exactly remember how old she was when she passed, and her assets were minimal. But he was the executor of the estate, and he was dealing with the challenge of a brother who disappeared more than a decade ago. And now his three adult children, how could he give to them the portion of their father's inheritance? Now, the judge said that the only way to do that would be to have the brother, who disappeared 10 years ago, declared dead. Now, the family feels certain he's not dead. They don't have any evidence that he is dead. But there's also been no contact for a decade. And so the judge laid out the process, and he reiterated that the brother would need to be declared dead and that his children would be the ones who would need to initiate that legal process. Think about that for a moment. Think about the grief that family has already endured. And now what lies ahead in terms of conversations they're going to have and decisions they're going to have to make and actions they're going to have to take and sworn testimony that they're going to have to offer if grandma's estate is actually going to be distributed to her grandchildren. This is not the way it's supposed to be. This is not how God intended families to function. And beyond double parking and eating too much fast food and listening to comedians, let me just say, this is the kind of deep sin and brokenness that God sent Jesus to redeem. And so today, when you know when your list of confession or sins that you're confessing before the Father and things that you're grieved over are personal and they're small, I want you to call to mind people who are living today in desperate need of God's redemptive touch, plan, the gospel, that would reach into these lives, these generations of brokenness, these situations in our American culture. Last Sunday in Sunday school, we talked about the book of Malachi. It's a short and worthy read if you've not spent much time in the minor prophets of the Old Testament. Malachi chapter 4 begins with these words. For behold, the day is coming, burning like an oven, when all the arrogant and all evildoers will be stubble. The day that is coming shall set them ablaze, says the Lord of hosts, so it will leave them neither root nor branch. But for you who fear my name, the Sun of Righteousness shall rise with healing in its wings. You shall go out leaping like calves from the stall. You shall tread down the wicked, for they will be ashes under the soles of your feet on the day when I act, says the Lord of hosts. Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and rules that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before the great and awesome day of the Lord comes, and he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and strike the land with a decree of utter destruction. And so what I want us to hear, first of all, is the promise of God of redemption and what it's going to be like. If you've never seen a calf leap out of a stall into a lush, grassy, warm field, then, you know, you need to anticipate that this spring when this winter thaw actually comes. But what is the law of Moses to which Malachi alludes? What are the statutes? What is the rule that God commanded at Horeb? Yes, he's talking about the Ten Commandments, but you got to remember that Jesus then says to us, hey, I'm not just fulfilling the law. I'm actually setting it before you magnified. I'm calling you to a higher righteousness. I'm calling you to utter holiness. I'm calling those who follow me to go beyond what the commandments actually require to the very heart of the holiness of God. Jesus is the one who said, Moses said, don't murder, but I say unto you, if your heart burns with anger towards someone else, then you've already committed murder in your heart. Moses said, don't commit adultery, but Jesus said, if our hearts are filled with lust toward others, we've already broken ourselves against the perfect law of God. Friends, the gospel's not simply about me and Jesus with the deal we strike in prayer over my personal sin for personal salvation. It's about the redemption of all things, and it's about the substantial restoration of relationships. Not just my relationship with God, yes, that's essential, and that's where it starts, but being restored to right relationship with myself, and then in right relationship with others. That's what our families need, that's what our world needs, and that's what the gospel offers. You and I are ambassadors of that kingdom and that king. We are agents of that grace, and we are ministers of God's reconciling love to the world. So pray with me today for those individuals and families with whom my path intersected yesterday in court. Pray for the children involved. Pray for the parents who are now considered severed or even dead, though they be physically alive. That is heartbreaking, and it is compelling in terms of ministry. So, for those of you looking for an opportunity on the courthouse steps, let me offer you this. It's called Courtside Ministries. Check it out at courtsideministries.org and consider becoming an agent of God's grace on the courthouse steps in your community today. All right, friends, that's all we've got time for today here on Connecting Faith. I'll see you right back here tomorrow. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. You can check out what we're doing at myfaithradio.com. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of Connecting Faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.